KPCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. Well, we're going to find out what's in store for our weather today. We're going to talk to Thomas Guiboy at the ABC Weather Center, a meteorologist, a man who predicts the future for a living. Before we get to the weather, Thomas, though, I want to hear what your prediction is for the name of the new NHL team that's coming to Salt Lake City.
Roger, that's a great question. I mean, I love hockey. It's one of the sports I played growing up. So the fact that Utah is getting its own NHL team, I'm jazzed up about it. No pun included right there. But I kind of like the I think my two favorite right now are the Utah Blizzard and the Utah Outlaws, what I've seen circulating online. What are you thinking?
I'm going with the Outlaws.
I think the Outlaws is very fitting, but I think with the Blizzard or with the Outlaws, you can't go wrong. But I could just see it now. If we go with the Blizzard, you have the Blizzard against the Colorado Avalanche. That built-in rivalry would just be fantastic.
Anyway, what do we got coming up in the weather?
So when it comes to our weather today, it's going to be a pretty nice day across the Wasatch back. We start a warming trend this afternoon. There's a weak system that's going to be clipping the state today. That's going to result in a little bit more in the way of cloud coverage. So instead of the mostly sunny skies like we saw yesterday, we'll see partly sunny skies this afternoon, but I think that we get through the day on the dry side of things, and we'll see a daytime high come in at 53 in Park City, while we could very well hit a daytime high of 60 in Heber. That's just a little bit above our seasonal average, but enough to set the table for what is going to be most likely a really nice day. Partly cloudy skies hold on through tonight with the overnight low dropping to 34 degrees, and then this weekend brings what I like to call Chamber of Commerce weather. High pressure will be in control. We'll see mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies both days, and each day will be a little bit warmer than the last. We'll likely be in the upper 50s tomorrow in Park City, could sneak into the middle 60s down in Heber, and then by Sunday, we'll have that full-on spring feel across the Wasatch back with that daytime high coming in at 64 degrees in Park City, which means spring skiing will be in full effect as we get basically towards our closing day when it comes to the ski season up around Park City. The mild temperatures will be holding on through the first half of next week. A weak system clipping northern Utah could mean a slight dip in temperatures on Monday, but I still think we stay nice and dry. Daytime high coming in at 58, and then through the first half of next week, we'll generally see daytime highs in Park City in the low to mid 60s, maybe in the upper 50s by Thursday. But once we get into Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, even though high pressure will still be our main driving force in the weather, the high pressure won't be as strong, and we could start to see maybe a few isolated showers and maybe even a few rumbles of thunder during the afternoon during the peak daytime heating, making it kind of really feel like spring. And by that point, overnight lows will be close to 40 degrees. So if you've been wanting a nice stretch of spring weather, looks like that we have that in store as we go through the next several days here, Roger.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Greg Mann, the superintendent of the South Summit School District, with his monthly update. Then the rest of the show is going to be about how big events treat Park City, because we're going to be speaking with Randy Barton. We'll be talking about the implications for Park City if the Sundance Film Festival decides to relocate. And then we'll finish our hour by speaking with Colin Hilton about the IOC's recent visit to Utah and the potential for an upcoming Olympic Games. As we just discussed with Thomas Guiboy, the National Hockey League's Board of Governors voted just hours ago to approve a $1.2 billion sale from Arizona Coyotes owner Alex Murillo to Utah Jazz owner Ryan Smith. The Associated Press reports that the NFL's and NHL's approval clears the way for the Coyotes franchise to move to Salt Lake City next season and be out here on the ice in October. The deal includes a provision for Arizona to get an expansion team if a new arena is built within the next 5 years. The NHL will facilitate the deal with a $200 million relocation fee going to league owners. Smith will take over the franchise's hockey operation, and Murillo will maintain his business operations in Arizona in an effort to secure and develop land for a new arena in North Phoenix. Murillo will retain the Coyotes' name, logo, and trademark, so Smith's group will have to rename the team. In other news, at least one more landowner has opted out of what could be Summit County's newest town. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the proposed town boundaries will change.
Derek Anderson, the landowner organizing support for a new town between Camas and Hideout called West Hills, will need to submit a new petition for incorporation. That's because at least one landowner opted out after consultants already ran the numbers on West Hills' financial feasibility. The Utah Lieutenant Governor's Office held a public hearing about the first feasibility study February 12th. Landowners within the potential town boundaries then had a month to request to be excluded. It was the second opportunity to request exclusion since West Hills area landowners petitioned for incorporation in May of last year. After residents got a first look, the would-be town shrunk from about 3,400 acres to 3,200 acres. The lieutenant governor's staff wouldn't say who or how many landowners requested exclusion this time, but under Utah law, anyone who wants out must own at least 10% of the incorporation area or 1% of that area's total market value. They must also live on the edge of West Hills, not in the middle. Anderson has until June 30th to submit a new petition for incorporation, and he told KPCW he intends to meet that deadline. It'll trigger a new feasibility study by LRB Public Finance Advisors, which will look at the new boundaries. In the new petition, Anderson may redraw West Hills boundaries entirely, since some who wanted to opt out didn't qualify under the law. According to Jordan Schwenke, who oversees incorporations for the lieutenant governor, if town boundaries change by 20%, Anderson will need to get new signatures on the petition. Otherwise, the original 10 signatures will suffice, provided none of those signatories have opted out. Once the lieutenant governor's office receives the new petition, and if LRB finds the new boundaries are feasible, a second public hearing will be scheduled. After that, Anderson and town supporters can collect signatures to put incorporation on the next November ballot. A simple majority of voters within the proposed town boundaries has the final say on West Hills. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
KPCW News time is 8:13. Here in the studio with me is Greg Mann, the superintendent of the South Summit School District. Morning, Greg.
Good morning.
Greg, let's start. I wanted to ask you, it's School Safety Week in South Summit. I understand that the school resource officer was honored at this week's county council meeting.
Yeah, we went and with the sheriff's department over to the county council building in Colville, and it was mainly to celebrate our first MOU with the county on a full-time dedicated SRO to South Summit School District.
Now,
it's a cost shared.
Is that a particular individual who is designated as the SRO?
It is. Okay. So it's a designated position that ends up being a designated person, and so we wanted to just acknowledge and appreciate the county and the sheriff's department and our school board for being willing to partner in a cost share for an SRO. So it's already having an impact in that we have an awesome SRO. It's certainly probably the best I've worked with, and I've worked with a lot. Just really gets in, plays basketball at lunch with kids. I mean, he does what as a dad I would hope he would do with kids. As a principal, I would hope that that's what an SRO would do. And as a superintendent, I'm excited to see that that's what's happening with our Summit County Sheriff SRO.
Now, if we're going to say such nice things about him, what's his name?
Wes.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk a little more about what Wes's job is. How would you define the parameters of what he's supposed to do?
Well, certainly Wes is there to help ensure quick response, especially for emergencies, certainly for school safety, student safety, all the things that you would expect and would anticipate that a law enforcement officer would do anywhere. Mm-hmm. But a big part of the job of an SRO is to build relationships and to be proactive rather than having to wait and be reactive. And so in my experience, SROs, especially really good SROs, effective SROs, they know the kids, they hang out with them at games kind of thing. Mm-hmm. they have a relationship and they build a trust and a rapport, and that actually is probably the piece that brings the most safety and the most calming effect, if you will, for students and staff. And as a parent, I felt that way also when I knew that my kids knew who their SRO was and that they cared for that person.
Now, will the SRO typically be around the school on almost every school day?
Every school day.
And does he appear in uniform?
He does.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the current arrangement with the SRO, is this consistent with the sort of recent legislative changes that have come down for school safety?
Well, so we actually started conversations, probably 2 years ago, I guess, with Sheriff Martinez. Sheriff Smith, he picked that up and really ran with it. He's a great advocate for kids and for schools. And so this is something we started quite a while ago. And HB 84 certainly brings a spotlight to that and enhances that. So it is part of HB 84 that passed through the legislature this past session. And there are things that every school across the state is working on to, you know, related to HB 84 and SROs or school safety people in some way are part of that.
And will you have to do some additional tweaks to be in full compliance with HB 84, or is what you have get it done?
No, that's a great question. So there's still things that we'll need to do. There are very few school districts around the state that aren't going to have things to do. Part of it, the HB 84 that we're talking about right now is every school is supposed to have either an SRO, a third-party contracted armed security, or what they call a guardian, which is an employee who, you know, nobody knows who that person is, but an employee who's armed it wouldn't be a teacher or anyone that's working directly with kids, because in an emergency, their focus is kids. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of the guardian approach. One of my sons who's gone through post and is a police officer, you know, his take is, hey, you know, we go through a lot of training for that, and you know, what a heavy burden to put on an educator. We will need to either increase SROs or contract with a third party vendor, or look at the guardian. In our board meeting last night, I let them know that I'd been meeting with Sheriff Smith about the possibility of more SROs, and so that's something that the board is positive about. You know, they'd like me to continue with those conversations to see what we can do.
And you may have said this, but it didn't register. You have one SRO now. Why would you need more, and would that be for other schools?
So each school actually is supposed to have something there. Yeah. There are some exceptions, but exceptions are, you know, rare, and they have to be approved through the state safety officer. And each school's, they're going to have something in place there.
Now, is there more than one school on the South Summit campus where the high school is?
The high school, no. So if you were to look at an aerial view of our Camas Valley schools, they're all within, from the high school to the elementary school is something like 0.6 miles as you drive, you know.
But it's too far for one SRO to effectively cover both.
Our elementary and middle school, they have there's a parking lot between them that they kind of share, an overflow lot, if you will. And so they actually, I believe, meet the criteria as one footprint. Mm-hmm. So that may be something that's able to be shared. But ultimately, what we're going to have to do is come up with the plan, submit it to the county safety officer, who, you know, they're working on getting, and then also to the state safety officer to approve or make recommended changes to our plans.
So there's obviously financial implications of having to, you know, bring in some additional SROs, even if the county is generously willing to share those costs.
That's right.
Those are costs.
Big costs. Right. Big costs.
How long will it take you to get your plans finalized and hopefully approved? What's the timeline?
Well, we need to have plans. You know, I'm not a fan of the minimum being the maximum, and I'm not a fan of waiting to the very end to get those things in. I've been able to have conversations with our state safety officer already. Plans are supposed to be turned in January, but we're already working on those. We started working on plans months ago, and we're continuing to do so, and I'm hoping to have things done well before the January deadline, so that if there are changes that are recommended, we can kind of figure out how to do that.
And I guess that, and going back to budgeting, that as you develop your plans, it's going to have some interplay with your next year's budget for both you and for the county.
That's right.
So there's a lot of ripple effects going on here. And I suppose that's happening all over the state.
It is. And our budgets typically, you know, we do our budgets in May and June.
Right.
And so I want to be on top of it.
You want to have had at least preliminary numbers by May and June, even though, that makes some sense. All right, Anything else on this topic before we move on?
No, I'm good.
Okay, I know the consideration of the student school board member applications was an item you had last night on the agenda.
Yeah, we got to welcome our two student board members for next school year. We have Bo Thomas, who's representing Silver Summit, and Emily Arvizo Oliveres for South Summit High School. And so it just was fun to have them come and get to introduce themselves and tell us why they were interested in a student board position, and it'll be fun to get to work with them. We have two great student board members that are going to be outgoing and that are just amazing individuals, and it'll be sad to see them go, but at the same time exciting because they're moving on to their next chapter, and it'll be fun to welcome Bo and Emily into their positions.
Now, how did Bo and Emily obtain these positions? What's the process?
So that you apply. And there, you know, it's not just a basic generic application. There's questions, things like that. And in some years, the board has student, you know, potential student board members come in, and they actually interview them in an open board meeting and make a decision that night. And Bo and Emily, they, for lack of a better term, they ran unopposed.
It's a good way to win.
It is. But they're dedicated to wanting to serve their students.
And what is the role of a student board member?
So student board members, as young and cool as I'd like to think I am, I'm not a teenager. I'm not a junior or senior in high. I still look it, I know. But,
this is radio. People can't tell how good you look. The fact that you and Fast could pass, and I suspect you get carded every time you go out to it.
Yeah, that's right. There's no gray hair or bald head here, you know. But so they bring a student perspective to the board. Mm-hmm. You know, our work really has to be centered on students and kids, and so it's important to have that perspective on the board. And there are times when, you know, it's common for board members to ask the student board members, what do you think? What's a student perspective on this? And they share that, and it has an impact.
And are they excluded from any kinds of deliberations, or are they of the board?
The student board members don't go into executive closed session meetings. Okay. That's about it. They're not voting members, but they're certainly helping inform the board members who are casting votes.
Okay. Had a master planning update. Anything significant there?
Well, we had facilities assessment done on all of our buildings, every one of them, and so we spent some time with the company that did that, and they went through and shared some of their findings, and it was fascinating. And we're hoping to be able to take that and kind of morph that into some sort of a maintenance and upkeep program so that we don't get behind again, because, you know, again, we want to be proactive rather than reactive. It's easier to budget that way. It's easier to just operate that way.
It's kind of like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. By the time you get to one end, you got to start all over again.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. You made a presentation on open enrollment for next year. How does that work, and how does that program work?
So Utah is an open enrollment state, and we have early enrollment, and then any time outside of that early enrollment time period is considered late enrollment. The state designates a specific time that's early open enrollment, and parents are able to apply for some people call them a boundary variance, you know, but basically they're applying to attend a school that is not the school that they reside in, you know, not that school's boundary. And that's really what open enrollment is intended to do, to provide a little bit more for parent choice regarding the schools that their kids attend. And
I assume it's capacity constrained.
It is.
So were you able to accommodate most of the requests that you got this
year?
Yep.
Yeah, we generally do.
Okay. So nothing else significant there? You haven't run into substantial capacity issues?
No, not yet.
Okay. All right. What else happened at the meeting last night that I forgot to ask you about?
Well, I was, as far as my update items for the board, I was excited. We're looking at some data dashboard companies to really bring our student data, not just the like end of level data, but data that's formative, that helps drive and inform instruction. We're looking at a few different. We've been looking at a few different vendors, and in fact, after this, I have a Zoom meeting with one. But it's part of our strategic plan, mm-hmm. And so I was excited to at least be able to update them on where we're at in that search. And then I think I mentioned earlier, about the SRO update and HB 84 requirements, I'm excited to continue that conversation with Sheriff Smith and see what's possible there. It was a good board meeting.
Last question, I always ask you this: what's the latest on your housing project?
Well, there's not a ton of update other than the board does have a working meeting coming up, and we'll be discussing and working through some of the latest and greatest things that we've learned about the affordable housing piece of that, and we want to go. Even though I want to go fast, we have to go slow to go fast, and we want to make sure that because of the long-term implications, that we do this right, whatever we do, and that we are able to inform the board along the way. So that's what our working session will be.
What would they be reviewing?
We're going to be talking about, so we've been meeting with Habitat for Humanity, for example, and so we have more information to share with the board on what's been shared with us as leadership, and so we'll be talking about that, and the implications of that, good, bad, or whatever, I don't know, we haven't had the conversation.
Okay.
So we'll just be giving them the latest update and talking through how that, how it impacts what we're doing.
Greg, thanks for spending time with us, and we look forward to chatting with you again next month.
Thank you.
The artist who's spearheading plans for a Book of Mormon-themed sculpture garden shared his progress with the Heber City Council Tuesday. KPCW's Grace Darfler reports.
Sculptor Stephen Neal says he moved to Heber specifically to build the Monument of the Americas, a privately funded park to celebrate the Book of Mormon and the founding of the United States.
We've looked at lots of different sites, but Heber is the most ideal place we've ever found.
The now retired plastic surgeon has been working on the statues, which he says came to him in a vision, for 29 years. Neal says the art puts stories from the Book of Mormon alongside stories from the country's founding.
Those who are familiar with the Book of Mormon know that it talks about the founding of America, that it was a divine event. What a lot of people don't know is that George Washington had a Moroni moment at the end of 1776, and so I've paralleled those two.
He says there will be more than a dozen sculptures in a part of the park that will be called the American Covenant Garden.
We want to make sure that people understand that our founding fathers were very religious people and they ascribed their actions to God.
Elsewhere in the park, sculptures will depict religious scenes like Nephi's vision of America and Jesus teaching his disciples. A total of 71 statues are planned, 18 of which have already been funded by donors. There will also be 20 bronze bas-relief panels showing scenes from the Book of Mormon. Mayor Heidi Franco thanked the artist for choosing Heber City as the home for his art and told him she was astounded by his vision.
I can't tell you how inspirational that quality of art is. It's just stunning and beautiful. I won't have to go to New York and Chicago, right, to the art museums anymore. We'll be able to have it right here.
A local developer donated private land to Neal and his team so the sculptures can be installed adjacent to the future Heber Valley Arts District, north of the city near Utah Valley University's Wasatch campus. The city council heard Neal's presentation because of the park's proximity to the planned public arts district. The whole park will be funded by private donors. Neal says admission will be by suggested donation. He doesn't want cost to prevent people from visiting. More information about the future Christ in America Legacy Park can be found on the project's website. An opening date hasn't yet been announced. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, in the studio with me is Randy Barton. On Wednesday, the Sundance Film Festival startled the community by announcing that it would be considering other venues for the Sundance Film Festival in 2027 and beyond. Here to talk about the implications of a Sundance departure is impresario, director of the Egyptian Theater, and host of The Local View, Randy Barton. Good morning, Randy.
Thank you very much, Roger. So first off, I want to make sure listeners understand that I'm here as myself, not as the impresario or the host of The Local View or The Egyptian. I have a unique perspective on this, Roger, because you probably may know this about me, but as a young man, I went to the University of Utah, and the way I put myself through college was by cleaning theaters. Mm. And I happened to be cleaning the trolley theaters that opened up in Trolley Square in 1972, and that is where this festival began. In 1978, it began as the Utah U.S. Film and Video Festival. It wasn't video yet, but and it was inaugurated not by Robert Redford, but by the state of Utah. It was mostly Serling Van Wagenen and Lynn Von Der Esch that started it, and it was started at Trolley Theaters. And I was there the very first year. I was managing the theaters at that point.
Went from cleaning to managing.
Yeah, well, you got to do it all when you're. And I just had a love affair with theaters, empty theaters, and I still do. I even love them more when they're full. And I just wanted to make sure that our listeners understand where Sundance came from, how it arrived at where it is now, and what I think about it right now, because I've been deeply involved since 1978. That was a one and done at Trolley Square that first year, but they did have the dramatic competition and the documentary competition, and Robert Redford was on the board of trustees of the group at that point. And it was his passion that pushed the festival, the Utah U.S. Film and Video Festival, towards the independent filmmakers and the creative people and the storytellers. And so it had that feel initially of what it has carried forward for all these decades, and that is a place where independent filmmakers can feel supported, embraced, and go on to do wonderful, artistic, creative things. Now, Robert at that point had the Sundance Resort, and in 1981 began something called the Sundance Institute, which had nothing to do with the festival. It was all about gathering creative people, these folks that had the great ideas for a story, and helping to flesh it out with live actors and give and take, and again, that supportive artistic environment that was anchored to a real place, which was the Sundance Resort, not Park City. The festival itself moved after that first year from Trolley Theaters to the Elks Lodge in downtown Salt Lake. And both the first 2 years, they had a featured director. The first year, the featured director was John Ford, and it was all about the Ford catalog. Mm-hmm. The second year, it was all about, Jimmy Stewart came. It was about Frank Capra, and Frank Capra was there. And it was a celebration of monumental creative people in the film industry, and this independent competition of dramatic and documentary features.
So that was an interesting dichotomy, because you have two sort of classic Hollywood directors that you're lionizing at the same time that you're sort of trying to embrace the independent film movement.
Exactly. And it was about, these folks started with ideas and passion and love of their craft to begin with, and look what wonders they were able to perform. But financially, it was set up as a 501c3 nonprofit group and floundered. It moved from one location to another location, didn't even have a fest in 1980 because it was the great idea to, why don't we kind of moved this to Park City because we have a new group up there called Debbie and Randy Fields with Mrs. Fields Cookies that have just purchased the Egyptian Theater and refurbished it and are willing to host us for no charge, basically. And so the festival moved from a summer festival, by the way, to the January spot. And that January spot was critical. I hear all these people in town say, oh, great advice for Sundance, so how it can be so fabulous. If only it was in April. You know, I mean, to me, that these people know what they're doing. That move to January put them at the front of the calendar of festivals, ahead of places like Cannes and the Montreal Festival and all these great film festivals around the world. This was that week is why they became so successful. And the festival, you know, when it moved here, it was just in the Egyptian Theater and the Holiday Three, which are no longer, you know, they're sitting there right now. So the Egyptian, you know, just feels so much like the home of Sundance. And Robert Redford, you know, in my opinion, is in the modern era, right there with Edgar and Pauly Stern with the impact on this town. And should be given, I mean, he should have a statue in front of the Egyptian Theater and be given credit for all he's done for this community. But it's important to know that Sundance, even now, after these decades, is not some great big corporate giant. They're a 501c3 nonprofit group without a real home. The Sundance Resort is no longer Robert Redford's. The Sundance Institute is the nonprofit group that was at the resort. And I think they always had a little difficulty figuring out, we can't really be located in Park City because we have the Sundance Resort and the Sundance Institute.
So what is your take on this week's announcement? Why do you think Sundance is making the announcement that it's thinking of leaving, and how would it affect the community if they did leave?
Well, I think it would be a monumental loss. You know, I was not surprised by the announcement. I've watched them over the past few years since COVID hit have leadership struggles. You know, they went through so many people. And I've watched, you know, sadly, the exit of Robert Redford from our stage and our community. I've seen them for 2 years completely cancel the festival. Third year, which was last year, come in this hybrid model. And this year, watch them shutter venues and try to figure out how to continue. So I was not surprised at all. But, you know, I think they're looking at how can they survive as an entity that, again, goes right back to that, how do we operate and best serve our mission, which is to support these creatives with independent storytelling through film and other mediums. Their digital medium now, obviously, has kind of taken over from the old style, sit in a movie theater and watch film.
Well, obviously, they're thinking about continuing a physical presence, right, and doing some kind of a hybrid. And I guess my question is, and the speculation I've heard around town over the last couple of days is, are they just acting like one of these sports teams who threatens to move unless we build them a new stadium? Is this a negotiating ploy to try to extract more from the community to entice them to stay?
Absolutely not. I think, they're artists operating from a place of passion for what they do. And they've stated the issues of affordability. You know, they don't have a home. Mm-hmm. And they have been talking about that home in the Arts and Culture District. And I have watched that, and it saddens me to see over the decades, Roger, the amount of money that we have put into recreation. If you take the ice rink, the Park City Mark, the ball fields, all of the recreation, the trails, the golf course, you take all the money we put into open space. You take all the money that we put into all those trails and transportation issues. How much money has been put into arts and culture to support the Sundance Film Festival, a local 501c3 nonprofit group?
So what do you think it would take to entice them to stay?
I think, me personally, or me as
a, personally.
I think we need to first of all rally around them and get rid of this idea that they are some big behemoth that's trying to muscle us into giving them a better deal. Mm-hmm. Number one, I don't know where this mentality of go away came from. That Park City became so popular that we now want people to go away. No, I mean, we want Sundance. We love Sundance. This is Sundance's home. So number one, that's got to be, we have the free transportation, we have the venues, but they're not secure. You know, they don't own a venue.
But of course, they wouldn't own them if they went someplace else either. So I mean, I'm no. As we think about a competitive landscape.
Well, right? I think we offer them a home, mm-hmm. a place, and a space. We through a grand collaboration, and we being the state of Utah. I mean, you know, the people that make money off of Sundance is not Sundance. It's the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. It's the county. It's the city.
And it's the vendors.
It's
and
the
it's the merchants on Main Street.
It's the lodging people. Yeah. It's the dining folks. Mm-hmm. It's everyone but Sundance. And we need to realize that they need to be given a stable, long-term home. We have theaters now that are empty, those Holiday Four. We have two on Main Street in Heber. We have a Camus Theater. We have spaces that are sitting that need to be guaranteed as a home for Sundance. And I think from them, as a nonprofit, what they need to do is consider, where is our home? Mm-hmm. It's always been Park City, but yet it's never been Park City. They've never had their own space.
Now, both the Chamber of Commerce and the city have come out with announcements saying that they would really like Sundance to stay. Do you think that there needs to be more of a local organization to sort of figure out how to support Sundance and get it to stay here?
I think it needs to be a grand collaboration, Roger, that includes the state, the county, the city, the chamber, Main Street businesses in Summit and Wasatch County, and individuals. We have individuals now in this community that have more net worth than the state of Utah. And they need to, we need to rally around this organization, not come at them with a suspicious point of view that they're trying to work us for better deals.
We will all be following this closely. Randy, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
I love to do it. I wish them the very best. They moved in, when we moved in, we being a group of young artistic actors in 1981, and we are their home, and we need to make sure they know that and that we as a community know that.
Thanks very much. So the International Olympic Committee spent 4 days in Utah last week ahead of the expectation that Utah will be awarded the 2034 Olympic Games. Here to share his impressions of that visit is Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton. Good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
So, interesting week last week?
Yes, it's always an interesting week, but what was really great to see was showcasing to them our absolute high level of preparedness, world-class facilities, and how compact and close proximity all of our proposed venues are. But what they were most impressed with was the warmth and welcoming nature of our people, the absolute terrific story of what we call a living legacy of the O2 Games, where not only are the facilities open and 100% being proposed to be reused for next games, but the amount of activity that are happening. And in every stop that we went to, there were elected officials, mayors, county council members, Olympians from the past, and young people today who are using them to train and have their big aspirations play out. So they were struck by that.
I imagine it was striking. Colin, about 10 years ago, I was in Barcelona. And I was walking around and I saw the former Olympic facilities of Barcelona, and it was like a Greek ruin. There was grass growing, the buildings were all falling down. There was nothing left in terms of a vibrant sort of facility. And that's just such a sharp contrast to what you've just described.
Well, and it really highlights what Utah is known for, right? We're a very prepared people for things. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was thought about not just hosting a great games in O2, but what to do with a legacy of those games and what to do with the facilities. And that has resonated, and 20 years later, it's showcasing itself very well.
Now, is a visit of this type typical as part of the venue selection process? Is this part of the way things normally go?
There is always visits early on, but this whole process that the International Olympic Committee is doing is very different than of the past. This is more of a dialogue and an invitation to come and learn about different locations and see where communities have interest to host. And, you know, this is in our DNA here in Utah. We love the Olympics. It is a bipartisan supported thing. It's a fun topic that everybody is really supportive of, and they felt that.
And so, again, from a process perspective, will they be going to other sort of venues for other games? How does it really work from an overall perspective?
So right now, we're the only preferred host for 34, but they are actually spending next week over in France looking at their facilities for 2030.
Right. So where the 2030 games would be in what in France? Is there another competitor for that games as
nope,
well?
No, they are the sole identified preferred host there. And so we're essentially going through a due diligence period, right, since we were indicated to be moving into this what's called targeted dialogue. Go ahead.
It's got to be very interesting. I mean, I can't imagine that France has the same sort of level of existing facilities that we do.
Everybody's got great attributes. There are regular hosting of World Cups in the Alps, sure. and they are a wonderful, and they will be a wonderful host in 2030.
So now, what sites did the committee visit? Did you participate in many of those visits?
Okay. Yeah. So it was spanned over 4 days, and we started at the University of Utah, right, where we're going to do opening and closing ceremonies.
At Rice-Eccles?
At Rice-Eccles Stadium, and then up to the village. We have an amazing ability to house all of the athletes in one village and then have all of the venues within 1 hour's drive.
So let's stay with that for a minute. In 2002, did they build some of those dorms? And would those be what would be used again?
Yes. So part of the initial capital improvements at the U of U was to build some dorms, and the organizing committee was a part of that. Mm-hmm. They have continued to grow to the point where we had approximately 3,000 beds back in hosting the O2 games, and they actually project that they'll have over 6,000 to 7,000 beds by the time 2034 comes. So that allows us to do a fun thing such as this concept that our board chair, Catherine Rainey Norman, really highlighted, the notion of an athlete's family village. So this is a concept that's very new and very exciting, because for the athletes competing in these big mega events, they're always having to have the parents and the family go, hey, how do we get tickets? How do we do things? So we're actually going to create a very unique ability to help with lodging, help with tickets, help with all the services that make athletes feel comfortable when they're in their biggest moment of their life.
So again, one of the critical things you just mentioned is the idea that every Olympic facility for where an event would be held would be within an hour of that village.
That's correct, and that is really unusual around the world. And just our wonderful geography, a great airport, and the fact that we have 100% reuse of existing facilities. We don't have to build any infrastructure. And what they felt was amazing. At Soldier Hollow, we had Emily Campbell, who is right here from Park City and our team Soldier Hollow, and was able to showcase how she is training in the sport of biathlon. And one of our IOC members from Slovakia, Danka Bartakova, she is a summer Olympian training for Paris and in the sport of shooting clay pigeons, if you will, dynamic shooting. And she got down, and they had a little fun competition amongst them, shooting at the targets at Soldier Hollow. And a little later in the visit, Danka just said, I needed this. I'm in the middle of my training for Paris, but to see the kids, the youth, the excitement of the community around the Olympics has given me so much passion and re-energized me for my next training heading into Paris. So those were the kind of things. We built up these great rapport with each of the IOC members. And in every stop, you know, down at the Olympic Oval, our IOC member from China, Hong, she got to see her training partners from 20 years ago who are coaches of ours at the Olympic Oval, who are coaching our short track speed skating. So it was a bit of a homecoming. And every stop, and we had, you know, well-known locals like Ted Ligety and Peekaboo Street and, you know, all sorts of athletes of every variety, every sport at each of these facilities that just told the story of how they trained here and how they're giving back with the youth programs.
I'm sitting here thinking about the organizational skill that it must have taken to get, for you guys, have everything ready so that this thing went as smoothly as it sounds like it did.
Yes, it was like a mini Olympics for our organizing or our bid committee here, but that's the fun of it. And it's about hosting the world here in the future. And we think that is such a privilege and such a great way to showcase Utah and how we welcome everybody. If you don't have a speed skating oval or a ski jump, you can come to Utah and train here. If you're a youth in the community, you get to go train and have Olympians of the past training you. And whether you're just having fun doing winter sport or chasing aspirational dreams all the way to be an Olympian, you can do it all.
You know, it's funny, Colin. A couple of weeks ago, we had Miles Radiman on talking about Park City's original organizing effort. And to him, the central theme was welcoming the world. And this is the same theme that you're talking about now. So this has been a consistent aspect of the Utah ethic, if you will, for hosting games.
Absolutely. And I think it really has shown what a great location Park City is, Utah in general is. We like to be good hosts, and we like to showcase the natural beauty and also really our people. The sense of volunteerism in the state, it was a big story back in 2002. It continues to be a story. And that, you know, in a world so divided, we need unifying events like the Olympic and Paralympic Games.
So what events will be held here, would be projected to be held here in Park City itself?
Yeah, so right, starting at Utah Olympic Park, we'll have the ski jumping, the sliding sports, and also some freestyle and snowboard disciplines.
At the UOP?
At the UOP and our new Eccles Olympic Mountain Center that we built in the last several years. Over at Park City, we'll have freestyle and snowboard competitions. At Deer Valley, it's freestyle skiing, moguls aerials, of course. And you know, down at Soldier Hollow, it's Nordic cross-country skiing and biathlon. Snow Basin for all the alpine skiing events. All the ice events at the Delta Center, Maverick Center, Peaks Arena in Provo. So we're across all the state, and it makes each of those communities feel very part of this big event.
Now, a lot of infrastructure is in place. I mean, virtually every venue, I think, exists.
100%.
Okay. So what projects would have to be undertaken? If it's not sort of venue infrastructure, what projects would you see having to be undertaken to get ready for 34 games?
Really, not any infrastructure from what the games needs. Now, what we are very excited to do is have the games be a certain date in the future to be a deadline. And deadlines are good. I use this line all the time, especially for, you know, big projects. So how do we mitigate traffic in Park City?
That's where I was
going.
You
know, and that is an everyday challenge right now. And we have a essentially a Wasatch Back Regional Transportation Committee trying to tackle that right now. And there are ideas and good plans. And if the games can be a catalyst to have that done by 2034, great. But it's not the reason for why infrastructure needs to be built. We see a lot of this 10-year run-up to the games as a great opportunity for communities to have their big vision-y ideas actually hopefully get done by that period. And it's everything from sustainability goals to traffic mitigation to you name the topic. And it's a patchwork of different stories in each of the communities. So I wear multiple hats. I run the Legacy Foundation, but I'm also on this bid committee as a volunteer. And we're trying to understand what each of the community's stories are, what their aspirations are, and how the games could be a help to provide some community benefit.
You know, it's interesting. 10 years is a nice number because, it, as you say, a deadline focuses the mind, but 10 years is enough time to sort of gather the resources and create the collaborations. It's a complicated dance you're talking about to try to, you know, get people in line to focus and come up with projects that are both buildable and helpful.
Yes. Well, and as Fraser Bullock, our leader in this effort and was a key leader back in the efforts up to O2, says, you know, we were all amateurs building up to the O2 games, trying to figure out what to do. We have a really good experienced team, and we have an experienced set of communities and operators of these venues. You know, Park City Mountain, Deidre, Todd Bennett over at Deer Valley, Luke Bodensteiner down at Soldier Hollow, Jamie at the Olympic Park. They have teams that are putting on events all the time. And again, we're gonna make this fun. Like, this is fun stuff. We need these kind of ideas and aspirational goals outside of just putting on a 3-week sporting event.
Colin Hilton, I suspect we're going to be chatting about this more in years to come as we get ready.
Yes, we will.
Thanks for spending time with us this morning.